Welcome to the Friends with Money podcast, brought to you by Money Magazine, creating financial freedom for Australians since 1999.
We're focusing this week on careers and making the most of your earning ability. Behavioural economist and psychologist Phil Slade joins me today to talk about the concept of getting comfortable with being uncomfortable and how that can help you in your career and moving up the job ladder. Thanks for joining me today, Phil.
Great to be chatting with you again, Julia. I always love our chats.
Phil, you recently told me that people need to get more comfortable with being uncomfortable. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, like I think culturally, particularly in Western society, we try to run away from discomfort or anything that causes any sense of personal conflict. And I think that can have some very negative impacts for us in the long run. And this is definitely something that we see. There was a really fascinating study about negotiation, and it's a tic-tac-toe scenario that I think I know a lot of from economists. You know, the prisoner's dilemma is a very common story, and people look at the prisoner's dilemma and decision making. And the prisoner's dilemma is very similar. Two robbers get arrested, and they get put in separate rooms. And the question is, what's the best outcome for those two people that have been arrested? Do they cooperate or do they serve themselves? And if they serve themselves, if one serves themselves and the other one doesn't, you know, tries to be cooperate, the person that serves themselves will win. If they both cooperate, they both kind of win, don't lose, you know, maybe they'll get a reduced sentence for both. But if they both cooperate, they both really lose because there's no leverage anymore. And so what do they do? And what should you do in that situation? The prisoner's dilemma has been talked about a lot from a decision-making science point of view. Often, though, in isolation, that's a one decision or one negotiation point that has huge effects over the course of your life. In real life, we make those decisions every single day. So they then looked at going, how do you look at what the best negotiation tactic when you realize that the outcomes of those decisions, you know, might be thousands of those across the course of a year, particularly in a team scenario. And what they found was the best outcome was when you did something called tit for tat, right? It's tit for tat. And that if you approach like you're going to cooperate, if the other person doesn't cooperate that time, then the next time you are what they call provocable. And so you say, well, I'm not going to cooperate this time because you didn't cooperate last time. And then you do that until the other person cooperates, and then you're endlessly forgiving. So you just immediately, once they cooperate, then the next time you cooperate when you play this over and over again. They did this experiment, I think back in the 60s, where they put this theory out there that said this is the best negotiation tactic. And they got these guys to write all the, you know, very smart people writing algorithms all over the world to see if they could beat this strategy or what would be the greater strategy. And tit for tat came out as the winner, you know, and the people trying to predict behaviors and things and what should be, you know, some people saying you just need to be constantly not call it collaborating, and that would be the winner. But no, this was the winner. They did this again 5 years later when everyone knew that tit for tat was the strategy. And the question was, just beat this strategy. And even when they knew that that would be the strategy that they were trying to beat in that scenario, they couldn't beat it. And so this is really interesting. We actually see this in everyday life where you're going to get ahead in life with whatever you're trying to negotiate with, particularly in a situation of collaboration, where your first position is to cooperate, and they call it being nice. Then if the other person doesn't cooperate, you are provocable. So you actually then go, okay, well, I'm okay with not that's the being uncomfortable with being uncomfortable, because I'm not going to cooperate with you now. And it feels a bit petty sometimes, you know, but it's like, well, if you're not going to play ball, I'm not going to play ball. You know, we both need to play ball here. So we're provocable, and then we're endlessly forgiving. So if this person doesn't, you know, the other person in question doesn't want to cooperate for 10, 11, maybe even for a couple of years, the moment that they decide to cooperate, you're cooperating with them. That's it. It's endlessly. Now, we do the opposite as humans. We approach with skepticism because we're scared that they're not going to be okay. So we don't approach with nice. We're skeptics. We're not provocable. We're polite. You know, and so we go, oh, that's fine. It'll be next time. And we're trying to create group harmony and like have a nice little team love in. And so we're not provocable. And then after a few years, we get resentful. And so we're not forgiving. We hold on to that stuff to the grave, you know, like that person is dead to me, you know, you're out. So we do the exact opposite as instinctively as humans. And as a negotiator, it's you've got to assume that other people want to win. You have to assume that they're going to cooperate. You need to be nice, but you need to be provocable and you need to be comfortable with discomfort so that other people have the opportunity to turn around. So even in a family situation where somebody's just being, I have to say this so that none of my family think that I'm talking about them, right? Which I'm not, but in many family situations that I talk to in my, in psychology, you get to talk to a lot of people, right? And so there's often a family member that's not being very good with the kids or not being very good with, you know, you join them and it ends up in a fight and things like this. And, or your partner feels devalued by this person who kind of keeps, you know, sort of demeaning them in front of the whole family. And so where there's a behavior there, you've actually got to be provocable. You've got to be uncomfortable with going, this is not okay. We're packing up and leaving today. You know, am I extracting yourself in that situation or doing something? But then the next day you sort of come back. And as soon as that person says, oh, I didn't mean that. You know, I can, and they see the consequence of their actions, and where there is a consequence, they change their action. And then it's up to you to go, great, cool. We're good now, because you'll be on the other side of the foot at some time. At some point, you're going to be the one that needs to change your behavior, right? And so you're wanting that endlessly forgivable behavior to extend, but it doesn't work unless you're uncomfortable with being uncomfortable. And when there's a power differentiation, that can be really hard. So it's easy if it's a brother or a sister. I think, what about if it's a parent or a boss, right? Or somebody that's in power in that situation that's actually doing something that's not okay. Being uncomfortable with being able to call that out and being provocable in a way that is just you being provocable is actually really difficult, but it's a key part of being able to navigate the politics of any organization or any people structure. So wherever there's a hierarchy in any part of life.
So Phil, to put this theory into practice, how would someone approach the idea of they need to go to their boss for a pay rise or to negotiate some sort of better deal? How does it work?
Well, often, so in the case of a pay rise, and we're going to assume that you've got some sort of legacy there, or where you've been able to do this tit for tat sort of negotiation, because that negotiation happens in the small things. And so this becomes one of the big things. So that if you've been a pushover, because that's what happens. If you're not provocable, you end up just being taken advantage of, right? And then you get resentful. And then when you come for that pay rise, you ask for the pay rise almost out of anger. Because you're like, I deserve this. This is mine, you know, and you should be doing this. And then that's going to get their back up. And they're like, well, you're not really that, you know, whatever. So by being comfortable and learning to be comfortable with when you get to that situation, it's not done out of anger. It's done out of opportunity. And it's done out of, well, this is what I think I'm actually worth. And here are the reasons for it. It becomes a much more measured conversation because you're uncomfortable with that little, with being uncomfortable. People that are not comfortable with being uncomfortable tend to be very, very nice until they explode. So their moments of, they have to approach that moment of uncomfortability with such force that it becomes a tour de force, right? It becomes almost an argument, bordering on argument. And then when it doesn't go well, it reconfirms in their head, see, well, that didn't work. You know, I tried to stand up for myself and now look at me now. I'm just, you know, and I'm worse in a worse off position. Well, that's because you were uncomfortable with it in the first instance, right? So learning to be uncomfortable, more comfortable with in uncomfortable moments is going to make you less reactive in those moments. It's going to make you less protective. It's going to make you feel less like your survival instinct is being attacked when you're feeling uncomfortable. So the fear element will go. And without that fear element, you're much better to be able to negotiate or navigate those interpersonal dynamics that can be a bit tricky.
So if you're starting a fresh relationship, for instance, and you're going in for a job interview, how do you make sure that you're making the most of, you know, the characteristics that you've described so far?
Yeah, it's good. I mean, job interviews are interesting, right? You have no legacy. You've got no history in that point. But I think even the way that you, so an interviewer, a good interviewer will challenge you in a question, in a moment of the question. And being able to, for instance, take a moment to think about an example. Silence in that situation can be extremely uncomfortable for a lot of people. So learning to be okay with that moment of discomfort means that you don't panic. You know, as soon as you panic in a job interview, it's not game over, but it's not good for you, right? You don't want to panic. So yes, being uncomfortable with silence, being okay with silence, being comfortable with those moments of uncomfortability, and a job interviewer seeing that you're okay with that will actually interpret that as intelligence, right? Because it's actually an emotionally intelligent thing to do, to be able to maintain control in those moments where you're not being in control. It also means that when you're asking, you know, and that you get to the inevitable question about, you know, pay and negotiating structures and things like that, you're okay with seeing your potential future employee squirm in their seat a little bit, right? So you need to go, you know, if you're, one of my earliest jobs, it was advertised as 110,000. So this is many, many years ago now, but 110,000. And I said, you know what? I actually know what I'll be contributing, and I know what it meant in this particular scenario, in this job. And I said, I actually think I'm worth 140,000. I'm unlikely to change my current job without that pay. I want to work for you guys, but you know that's kind of what I need. This is my family, and the guys got really uncomfortable that there was three men who were interviewing with me, and they were all big, powerful, you know, guys as well, you know, like they presented power, you know, they had the whole seating arrangement where they were even sitting higher than me, you know, so it was really quite bizarre. I was okay with that. It's like, well, you know, it's like, I'm okay with this because that's just the reality. And it wasn't aggressive. It was very matter of fact, but I was okay with them just sitting there and letting them talk about themselves. I didn't try to go, oh, but I hear you're uncomfortable with that. So 130 might be okay. Well, 120, in fact, you just tell me what you can do, and we'll go with that. That's what being uncomfortable does in that moment, right? You're trying to quell or pour water over the little fire that you might have created. Being comfortable means I'm okay with just letting them sit with it, because they come back. The truth was, if they were to come back at 125, I'd probably would have gone, yeah, okay, cool, you know, let's, or you know, or maybe not, you know, who knows? But they actually came back and said, yeah, okay, we can do that, and that's a classic scenario of just going, okay, let's work it out. You know, the next question was, does that include super or not include super?
When you've set that up,
yeah,
what then happens in the relationship going forward with these people? Where are you standing?
Yeah, I think what it does is it allows what it says to those future employees is that I'm okay with being transparent, and I'm not going to be an asshole about it, right? I'm not going to be difficult. I'm not going to create massive amounts of pain because of anger, you know, because this is about negotiating without the prevalence of anger or anxiety, right? And so that's actually instinctively, if you get too angry in that moment, even if you do deserve that pay rise, the reaction, the reaction is not going to be, I don't want to give you the pay rise. The reaction is, I'm not sure I want to reward that behavior. Right. So, or I'm not sure I want that person I'm going to go with my second choice because they were at least, I felt like I could work with them a little bit better. You know, what happens if we have a difference of opinion and they just arc up, right? So it puts you in a much stronger position if you're able to keep your emotions in check in those moments of uncomfortability, because that's exactly what you're doing. When you feel uncomfortable, being able to keep your emotions in check, your anxiety and your fear in check in those moments is the key. And that's actually what they're going to reward, is your ability to control your emotions. And that's what they're going to see is worth the extra money or the extra pay rise or the extra benefits, whatever it is that you're negotiating for.
So when it comes to other confrontations that you may have in the workplace, so if you're managing staff, you may have issues with performance, or on the other hand, your manager might ask you to do something that you're not comfortable doing. How do you manage those discussions?
Yeah, and I think there's another nuance to that too, is when you feel comfortable with confrontation and the person that you're talking to feels comfortable with confrontation, but the people around you are not. And all of a sudden, so I had this situation in the workplace where another person and I were having a confrontation, but we were doing it in a semi-public way. And some of the guys that were underneath me said, I don't feel safe now because I feel like that there's confrontation in the room, right? And so as a manager, I felt a responsibility to create a psychologically safe workplace, of course. And so that I had to take them through this whole process of feeling uncomfortable with comfort. But I also had to be mindful of the impact that you're having, even if you are both comfortable with uncomfortability, right? It's a complex scenario. So I think there is always a point where, and in that particular scenario, the confrontation did spill over into that, probably went too far. Like it did actually go too far. It was okay for us. If we were, you know, by ourselves, then we could have, you know, gone hammer and tongs, but it just wasn't appropriate in that situation to go as probably as hard as we did. And so that was a learning for me as well, to go, I need to find out how to navigate confrontation without it turning into an argument, not just for the relationship with the person I'm arguing with, who I still have a great relationship with today, but also for the impact that it has on other people. So I think you've got to know the person that you're talking to a little bit. And I think this is, you know, people tend to fall into three categories or three, they have three types of worldviews. There are some people that value the strength of the group is important. That's how we win, is that as long as we keep the group together and strong, that is important. It doesn't matter whether it's right or wrong, whether the data is saying they're more interested in what the group says. You've got another group of people that are like, what's the data saying? What is the data telling me, and how is the data leading the decision making? And I don't really care what the right thing to do is or what everyone else thinks. What's the data saying? And you got another group of people that don't really regard the data, or they use the data to the extent that it serves their purposes of what they think is right. So what's the right thing to do in this situation? Because the truth will set you free, right? That's that third group. So you've got to know which, because when you're in these situations of negotiation, you're talking to people's reactive side, not necessarily their conscious side. So what you're trying to do is two things. A, you're trying to talk to their reactive side so they don't get into a reactive state, because as soon as they get reactive and their emotions take over, you've lost the ability to communicate in a rational way. Sometimes in negotiation, you want that, right? You want to actually trigger their irrational behavior because it's going to lead them to a decision that you want. Other times you're actually wanting to have a conscious conversation and not trigger that reactivity. So you've got to think about that beforehand and sort of know how to navigate that, know the person you're talking to, and know what to do when that reactive self comes out. Because when you see that reactive self, we call it the ape, because that's the part of the brain that you know, here in our brains that are also in chimpanzees. Like all of us have got an ape brain in our heads. And when our apes come out, we've got to wait till our apes settle down before we can have a general conversation. But I would say that knowing that, whether it's the truth will set you free, whether it's the strength of the group, or whether it's the data, is an important way, because that's how you start to approach that conversation. And you can sort of go in with all three and just see if you make an argument and it doesn't sort of float, just drop it and go with another one. So for instance, in data, you might start with the data. He might say, look, this is what we've done across the year. This is the you know, presented as a statement of fact. And if we do this, and I'm worth this because you're still in this sort of money, and this will work out well. If that doesn't work and they go, yeah, what? But you know, it's something about, I just don't feel this is the right thing to do. Then you've got to go, well, how is it right for us? How does giving me, for instance, a pay rise, or maybe it's more work from home flexibility. How does, let's take flexibility as an example. How does flexibility better align with the company values, better align with what it means to be working for this company, better align and strengthen the identity that sits behind working with this company? That's actually the line of negotiation, not the data that says I'm going to be more productive because I can focus for longer hours and things like that. If it's the strength of the group that's important, neither of those things will really resonate. They'll make sense and they'll go, yeah, I get that, but I'm still not convinced. So with a groupie, as we call them, that's the shorthand for it. And I'm a groupie, so you know that tends to happen. It's kind of like, how is the group going to better perform with increased flexibility? How is that going to impact the culture of the place in the way that's going to make people stronger, more connected, feel more human, you know, because of the respect and all those sorts of things. And that's where your starting point of negotiation is. So I hope that that is an explanation, kind of starts to nuance that argument a little bit. And you've got to do your homework, right? You've got to go into these conversations knowing, sort of having thought through those different arguments so that you can then pull it out as appropriate. And it could be a 2-minute conversation. It could be a half hour conversation. It could be a 3-day negotiation. Who knows? But this is the point.
So part of the homework, I guess, is, as you say, if you know the person, you try and figure out what their next move will be after you present whatever it is that you're going to present to them.
Mm. Yeah, and it's not just hammering your presentation again if it didn't land well the first time. Like if it didn't land well, yes, it might be that you didn't articulate it, but it's kind of like if a person is deaf, speaking louder isn't going to help. You know, like, and it's that sort of thing where somebody can't hear what it is that we're saying, so we just say it again but louder, and it's like you've got to figure out a different way to say it because it's obviously not resonating. Yeah, there is a bigger negotiation strategy that's around sort of the way that our brain processes information, but that's probably a separate thing and more relevant to actually negotiating over a period of time, which is something slightly different as well.
So, Phil, what tips can you give to help people overcome their discomfort?
Practice. I think practicing in small ways. So whenever you've got a situation where you feel it isn't in your interests in a way or doesn't serve the interests of the group, and it can be with your kids, it can be with your partner, it can be with your parents, it can be with your friends or your work colleagues. It can be as simple as going, they all want to go in for beers and burger for lunch. And you're like, actually, I don't, you know, I'm on a diet. You know, can we do something else? It can be as simple as that and being comfortable with that level of annoyance that someone else gets a bit annoyed or they'll say, you know, you don't need that, you know, whatever. So can it just start small and realize that being uncomfortable isn't always the worst thing to do. And you practice it like anything in life. I think when it comes to finances, I think practicing with money is important. So if you're in a relationship with someone else that where you haven't learned how to negotiate spending limits or how to save or how to set up the accounts, or you haven't learned how to talk about a particular behavior, a spending behavior of your partner that you don't, you know, that you think might be detrimental, figuring out how to have that conversation where you are feeling uncomfortable and keep a lid on your own emotions so you don't run away from it, you don't try to placate it, you get to the end point. I think that's really important because if you can do that in your personal life, you're more likely to be able to translate that into your professional life. And just like conscientious, you can work on becoming more conscientious over time. It's almost like a part of, yeah, they think about personality as being something that's immutable, but actually things like conscientiousness and agreeableness, you can actually practice. They're a skill that you can do. It's a way of looking at and explaining past behavior, but your past behavior doesn't necessarily have to be how you approach your future behavior. So learning the art of disagreeableness in a way that doesn't kill your future career is actually an art. Often being more comfortable with being uncomfortable is a negotiation tactic that you use to your advantage. So this happens when you're buying a house, right? If you're buying a house and you're more comfortable with saying something uncomfortable, or buying a guitar or buying anything, negotiating, I teach my boys this all the time, the price that's listed there, even with the car that I bought not too long ago, there was a price point. In my head, I go, where's the price point that I would feel uncomfortable offering the price to? You know, it might be, we had a couch that was only online for $100 and it was like worth like $500. And I thought, in my head, I'm thinking, what's the uncomfortable price? The uncomfortable price was actually asking for $40. Like, that's ridiculous. Like, you know how, like, you can imagine yourself in that situation, the uncomfortable moment that somebody's says it's $100 and you go, well, I'll probably give you $40 for it. That moment there, that feeling is about uncomfortability. Now the other person now is going to feel uncomfortable as well. So what they do in that situation is important because they will either go, oh yeah, okay, sure, that $40, that'll be fine, which is actually what happened in that situation because they're uncomfortable with being uncomfortable. And so in order to mute that feeling they will often cave to the request. Or they'll get angry and go, oh, no, you don't know what you're talking about. Screw you. I'm going to sell it to someone else. You know, go away. You know, and so they'll get angry. Now, I was okay with that. You know, you've got to be okay with, that's the art of negotiation, is being able to be okay with you know, being on the wrong end of that stick. But they've actually lost out as well, right? They've now got to go through someone else to come and someone else to look at it, and they'll probably still sell it for $80. Whereas in that situation, if they control that feeling of being uncomfortable and then being offended by it all, then they still would have got a great price, and we would have had a good conversation, and it would have been all over in the matter of seconds. So that's an example in a small way of how this learning to be comfortable with being uncomfortable works to the advantage of the people in that scenario, particularly in interpersonal dynamics. But when it's one way, like investing, it's still, to the extent that you're worried about your image or what it means about you, what it could be, just being comfortable with that emotion, working with that emotion and not letting it overcome you and embracing it as your body's indicator of just helping you in that moment as best it knows how, yeah, will always help you win.
Well, thank you very much for joining me today, Phil. It's always fascinating to hear about how our behaviour does affect the way that we're perceived, the way that we interact with others, and potentially our future earnings.
Julia, it's always a pleasure. I always feel more intelligent after my conversations with you than before. So we're both winning, right? This is a win-win.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to behavioural economist and psychologist Phil Slade on Friends with Money. Please remember you can subscribe to Friends with Money wherever you listen to your favourite podcasts.
Thanks for listening to the Friends with Money podcast. For credible, independent and easy to understand financial commentary, visit moneymag.com.au. Please remember that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are general in nature, and further independent advice and research based on your personal circumstances should be sought before making an investment decision.